Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today about saving and restoring Illinois prairies with Mike Polito, a senior here at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you for cutting short a bit your visit home or your time away at spring break and with family to come back for this radio program, which is live every Sunday night here on WILL. Let me remind listeners, you're encouraged to call in with comments or questions. The number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Elsewhere, if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. Well, Mike, how did you get interested in restoring prairies?
That's a bit of a story. It goes back to when I was a little kid and my parents were looking for summertime activities. The local park district was offering something called Nature Camp, and a couple of my friends had gotten signed up for it, so they dumped me in that for a few weeks, and that started some interest in natural areas. And then that was that for many, many years until I came back to the park district and started volunteering with them in high school because, again, my parents wanted me out of the house. And I found that I actually enjoyed that a lot, so when I got to U of I, I found Red Bison because it was actually relevant to some of the work the park district had done.
Now let's take a minute for that name, Red Bison. That's kind of an unusual name for a group. Tell us about it.
Red Bison, it's a metaphor. It's based off of a Native American term for prairie fires. They would use that to label the prairie fires because it was similar to a herd of red bison. The prairie fire would appear rumbling on the distance, and then it would come rumbling, roaring through whatever area and leave everything trampled and blackened, just like as if it were a herd of red bison. And so we just took that for our namesake because it was more exciting sounding than Prairie Restoration Club.
Now, you grew up in St. Charles, so that's where the park district was that you first started doing this kind of work.
Yeah, the St. Charles, it's a nice little suburb town that it's growing by the day, but one thing about it is that it has a nice little set of natural areas throughout it, forests and prairies and some wetlands, and so you get kind of some experience to all of them on school trips and especially when you go volunteering with them.
Now, those natural areas up there in St. Charles and other places around the metropolitan Chicago area, are those native prairies that have been saved, or have they been reconstructed, as it were?
The prairie sites that you're going to see more often than not, any area that's a prairie was restored. Very, very little of Illinois is a remnant prairie anymore. So, yeah, oftentimes, unless it explicitly says somewhere on the entrance, sign, it's going to be a restoration, and St. Charles is no exception.
Now, I remember from conversations before with people who are involved in this kind of work that there are some remnant prairies, but they're in kind of surprising places, like graveyards.
Yeah, one of the things with the remnant prairies is that, way back when in the 1800s, people were tearing down forests left and right to plant their crops in, because if it can grow a tree, it can definitely grow a stalk of corn. But then John Deere came along and his steel plow, you could end up plowing down the prairie, and they found that worked much better. So just about everything that was prairie got plowed under and planted on, and all that was left aside was little tracks along railroads that nobody could use or also set aside for graveyards for future deaths, which is kind of grim and sad, but at the same time, it's happy because nobody got around to burying anybody in some of these areas or doing anything with these sides of railroad tracks, and now we have some leftovers.
Now, Red Bison, the group that you're president of on campus, this student group has studied prairies, and many of the students have taken courses in the restoration of prairies and the history of this part of the world, natural geography of the prairie states. And so My wife and I have been very fortunate to be able to go on some of the tours that your group has given mm-hmm. to some of the remnant prairies near Champaign-Urbana. And so we have gone through some of the cemeteries where there still are, where it's never been plowed under.
Yes, yes. There are a couple in town, well, not really in town, but nearby. Loda Cemetery Prairie is like the crown jewel of this general area. It's an incredibly diverse one. I believe it has at least some form of state protection, if not federal protection, because it's so diverse and such a good habitat. I believe there's over 100 different species of plants living in that area, including an endangered lotus of some sort. The specifics are lost to me at this moment. Another one that you may have been to is Prospect Cemetery Prairie. Both of these are just north a ways, I think. One of them is obviously in Loda, that's where it gets its name. And Prospect, I can't remember just where that is exactly.
I can't remember either, and that may be just as well, because one problem with these prairies is if too many visitors come and things get trampled and there aren't really paths through some of it, and so it's hard to see all of the varieties that are there unless you're very, very careful and with an expert guide.
Yeah, when there's 100 or so species in an area, no normal person is going to be able to identify them and show them out. It's best to have someone who knows what they're looking at to go with you to point everything out to you.
So some of the things your group does, this Prairie Restoration Group, Red Bison, is give tours to people so they can go with a guide who's careful and know what they're doing. What other projects do you do? What does this club do most?
What we do most is tend to our two native sites that we steward. We have a prairie site south on Route 45 between Curtis, Windsor, 45, and the railroad alongside of it.
This is in the city of Champaign and Savoy.
Yeah, exactly. That's the border there. It's about almost a mile long and about 30 yards wide, the whole route, which is a difficult tract of land to use for anything, which is why it's been left as a prairie, I suspect. We monitor that. A lot of what our efforts involve there are removing invasive species as well as collecting seeds and trying to promote some more native ones in their stead. And then we have our forest site out west, no, east, my apologies, east by Danville along the Salt Fork River. We go out there, and again, it's kind of the same idea of removing invasive species, and we do what we can to promote some native ones there as well. But since it's farther out, we spend a little less time on that.
All right. We're talking with Mike Polito today, who's president of the Red Bison Prairie Restoration Group, about saving Illinois prairies and restoring them. Listeners are encouraged to give us a call, 333-9455. We'll reach our studios here at WILL. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Happy to have your comments or questions for Mike. Mike, you mentioned invasive species. Now, here are all these plants growing in this area. Why are some good and some bad?
Invasive species. It sounds really fancy. It's just a glorified name for weed when applied to plants. What happens, in order to get the term invasive species, it has to be a foreign plant that does just fine wherever it was coming from. Let's take the example of, they call it Canada thistle. It's actually from England, I believe, or Europe. It grows just fine. It's got its own sets of controls, checks and balances over there to make sure that it stays put in the ecosystem. But when they brought it over here, for reasons I can't understand, it suddenly explodes because whatever was eating it in Europe is no longer here, and whatever plants were competing for resources in Europe are no longer here. And so it explodes in our natural areas. And then,
so it can just take over a whole area.
It can and it does if you don't stay on top of it. Yeah, there are many species like that you have to watch.
Kudzu is famous,
kudzu,
of course.
Kudzu is, yeah, it's more further to the south, and there are lots of pictures online of that eating cars, it looks like, right, as it grows over everything. Yeah, that one's a real mess, too. I believe that one's from Asia.
So here's this thistle called the Canadian thistle here, that can just take over if it's left alone. So what do you do with it? How do you get it out?
The Canadian thistle, that one, what we end up doing is depends on how big a problem it is, how long it's been rooted in place and established. If it's a huge problem, sometimes it's all you can do to just try and keep on top of it, and you'll just mow it, or you'll go out there with a heavy-duty weed whacker or something to just try and knock it down for the year so it doesn't go to flower and go to seed, and then just hope that you can hamper it that way. But if it's at least in a more manageable-sized plot, then you can go out and herbicide it. There are various herbicides to use, again, depending on just how big a problem it is. I believe Transline is an effective one. If you have a big area and you just want to spray a decent-sized area, Transline is fairly specific, and it doesn't kill everything else around it. But if you're actually going out and being very precise, then you can use other things like Garlon or even Roundup, things that kill all sorts of plants. So
now, this gets more complicated, I believe, because there's some thistles that are native, right?
There are a few species of native thistle, yeah. Yeah, I believe they're just called prairie thistle or something like that. It's some boring name, that's why I can't remember. But the important part is to be able to identify it, and that is something I am capable of. So you got to just check what you're killing. That's one of the most important things I tell our volunteers when we do, in fact, go out and battle these species to make sure they're hitting the right ones.
Now, when some people think of environmentalists as folks who are just adamantly opposed to things like herbicides, and yet you've said here's your group that's trying to preserve something that's very native to this region, but you find it necessary at times to do that.
It's absolutely necessary. We would love to be in a situation where we don't have to use herbicide or anything like that, but it's just we don't have that luxury. Herbicide happens to be the most effective way to battle some of these things. And so long as you use it responsibly, it doesn't end up having any problems like that. We end up going through a level of certification. The Department of Agriculture, the state's Department of Agriculture, actually has a test to make sure that we know what we're doing in general areas. It applies mostly to agriculture, but it still is basic rule of thumb for herbicide usage.
So you're careful that you don't use so much that it gets down into the water supply and gets spread around.
Absolutely, yeah. You have to be careful of what time you use it and how much you're using, not just so that you don't overdo it, but you don't want to be wasting your herbicide either. That stuff's expensive. So it's important to know what you're doing for several reasons, some of them being economic.
Now, you mentioned using other tools to get rid of these invasive species, and I suppose home gardeners who are listening might be curious about some of those. Some people who have planted prairie plants near their home might want to know how to take care of them, how to keep other invasive species out. Sometimes you do very simple things like pull them up by the roots.
Absolutely. It just depends on the plant you're fighting. That's going to determine what tool you use. If you just have prairie plants in garden beds and stuff like that, like many people have in the area, your best bet is to just use whatever simple, normal garden tools you've been using for weeding. But if you have a small native planting or something in your backyard and you want to get a little bit more heavy duty, you could go out and buy some loppers. They're like the little hand loppers you would use for pruning trees, but they have extended handles, which allows you to get a lot more force on the target and take down bigger things if you have bigger things. You can pull out some of the ones that don't have thorns on them are pretty simple to pull out. And if they do have thorns, maybe you just want to take a weed whacker, maybe with some metal blades on it as opposed to just the string whip. That would probably help you most. You can find these kinds of attachments at just about any hardware store. Just go to the power tool section and they'll show you.
And what about using a spade to try to dig down and get the roots up that way?
If you want to try and dig them out, that can be, it depends. If you're in a actual prairie planting, you'll have to compete with the prairie's own roots, and that's quite a difficult chore. So uprooting things in a prairie is rather difficult. But yeah, if it's like a forest natural area, I know people with forest plots in their backyard, that's a possibility. You could also do it in your garden little planting as well. But yeah. Really, any tool that you've used for weeding in the general sense, in your gardening sense, will apply. It just might be a little bit difficult to use in a large, broad-scale project.
Sure. I remember one of the first tours that my wife and I took with Red Bison, someone handed out a little sheet of information about prairie plants, and it showed us what we would not be able to see, which was the roots of the prairie plants. And in this part of Illinois, the kind of plants that were growing here before farming really swept in with a vengeance had roots that went down.
Well, they go down very, very deep.
Several feet.
Yeah, they go down anywhere from 3 feet. Some of them drop all the way down to like 10 or 12.
Wow.
There's a species called, I believe it's called lead plant. It got the name Devil's Shoestring, I believe, because it was one of the few plants that would stop that steel plow with this 12-foot-long taproot down to the bottom of the earth, it would seem. And it would hit it with their plow and just jolt the entire horse train.
Huh.
It was a real pain for them. And that's a really nice plant to have in your prairie because it's so deep and so well established once it gets going.
But and it really holds the soil there so firmly.
It does a very good job of holding the soil. These roots, they go very deep. The idea is not to hold the soil together so much, but to get to the water. Because Illinois has such a penchant for dry spells, it's important that the plants be able to reach whatever water level, water table there is down there. So that's why they'll shoot down so many feet. And it also has the added benefit of having all these roots in the soil when the plants do eventually die. These soils add a lot of organic matter, and that's why we have this rich black earth in east central Illinois.
Tell us a little bit more about that. How does that process work?
So, okay, what'll happen is, I guess it comes down to all the way back when it started, we could go, the glaciers came down and pushed everything out of the way, and they pulled back, and there was all this silty soil left over, and it fluctuated between forests. I believe it started out as forests, and then there were some dry parts, and the forest died off, and prairies, grasslands moved in, we now call them prairies, and they took up root. It's really a fairly young ecosystem, I think only about 8,000 years old, which is relatively young for such a thing to be established like this, but it's been growing like that, and the plants, it's just an ebb and flow of life where they grow up and then they die and they deposit their organic matter on the surface where it gets immediately used up and then way deep down in the soil where it can't always get used up and it just accumulates over time. We have some of the richest soil in the world because of that, and I'm not bragging. That's just the truth.
Sure, sure. Now, tell us how fire plays a part in that cycle.
Yeah, fire, it's another one of those, like the herbicide, it's kind of a tough love thing for the prairie, but it's evolved to be accustomed to it. Fire would regularly come through the prairie back before colonial days. It would either be started by Native Americans who used it for hunting, to try and, you know, corral buffalo into a kill zone of some sorts, or it would be started by a lightning bolt on one end of the state and just rear across the other because there's nothing to stop it. But, the fires would come fairly regularly. The plants are adapted to it. These deep roots have the added benefit of being able to not get burnt up in a fire, and then the plant can resprout the next spring or fall after it's been burnt off. So it's really a good thing, too. You can see when a prairie hasn't gotten burned, some of the plant's composition changes. The species composition will change. Some of them spring up right after a fire. They're very opportunistic. And then others will slowly shamble back and then push out those opportunistic ones. And then the fire comes through and it recycles this process. So all these species can survive in some kind of cycle, but not all at the same time. So that's why you have such a diverse system. That's why it works that way. You get so many species in an area. Also, fire is a very important concept when it comes to keeping a prairie, because if you were to just continuously not burn it and starve it of fire, eventually trees would take root and continue growing into trees, and you'd eventually have a forest. So, yeah, fire is what sustains a prairie.
We're talking with Mike Polito on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. He's a senior at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign studying integrative biology and chemistry. Now Mike, does chemistry have much to do with this study of plants?
Well, chemistry, it's more of a side note. I don't know how I fully got into that. Integrative biology applies. There's a lot of ecological principles that you learn in biology that apply to a prairie ecosystem. The chemistry itself, maybe less so. I suppose I could try and figure out why the herbicides do what they do. But no, in terms of actual just the ecological restoration, trying to make a healthy ecosystem, it's not so important.
Let me give the phone numbers again for callers who might like to ask a question to our guest today. 1-800-222-9455 will reach the studio from anywhere the program is heard, including on the internet. This program can be heard live streamed by your computer at will.illinois.edu. Click on AM and you'll hear this program as well as others on this station, of course. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, call us at 333-9455. I see we have a caller on our toll-free line, line number 4. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I'm driving back from Kentucky to Pontiac, Illinois, and I've been a prairie person for about 40 years. I was introduced to prairies at Knox College in Galesburg by Pete Schramm, who was a pretty big person in prairies at that time. There's probably only 3 or 4. But I just find them fascinating and have visited many of the little cemetery prairie graveyards around. There's several around Pontiac. And at one point I was going up in an airplane, and it really struck me, you know, as I got up over the land, how vast those prairies must have been. You know, it's really hard for us to grasp, I think, how widespread they were. And I don't really have any questions for you because I know a lot about prairies too, but I just wonder what your thoughts are on people's awareness today about the prairies, whether there's much interest in preserving them or, you know, what we have left. And I'll just listen.
Okay. So
great. Appreciate the call. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
There's a decent amount of interest in prairie restoration, prairie preservation. At least I know there are several groups in this general area, the Champaign County area, that are also dedicated to some kind of restoration work. You have Grand Prairie Friends is one community organization that does stuff. You also have the Champaign County Forest Preserve has many different sites they watch over, as well as various park districts, Urbana Park District. There's even a new program, some Master Naturalist program gone into effect to train people in how to better take care of and manage prairies as in other natural areas. Naturalist program is pretty general, but it does affect the prairies as well. I know, at least on my end, Red Bison has a steady supply of volunteers and workers. We always get a huge showing in the very beginning of the year after we've advertised our group on Quad Day. And this very large group comes through, and some we never see again. But I know, at least in some way, shape, or form, they were interested in the prairie, even if they weren't interested enough to come out every Sunday.
So these are college students who, in the fall, when they first get here to campus or return to campus, you advertise the opportunities to get involved. And one of the things you have them do is every Sunday, or almost most Sundays at least, when the weather's tolerable, you get out and actually do physical things in the prairies.
Yeah. We do go out. We shoot for every Sunday. And then, again, the weather's not always helping us. But we shoot for every Sunday. We go out and we do the invasive species removal is our favorite activity, I would say, because it happens to be the most necessary. It is physical work, and it's actually interesting because it doesn't actually need someone who knows everything about natural areas restoration to do. We have lots of people from all sorts of majors. I know there's at least a few business majors. We've had physics majors in the past. There was a history of philosophy major coming through as well. So it takes all kinds.
And you have community people, older folks who join you too.
Absolutely, yeah. We are joined by members of the community, not just students. It's mostly students, but there's always a good core of non-community members that we can count on to come help us out too.
Well, now since it's spring is coming, let's see, have we already had spring officially start? I guess we did Thursday or something.
Yeah, I think it was like last week or something.
But people may be interested in getting outside more. If somebody wants to volunteer, how can they do it?
If they want to help out with Red Bison, well, they can probably just Google Red Bison, it'll take you to our homepage.
And that's R-E-D and then B-I-S-O-N, Red Bison.
Yeah, if you just search for it on any search engine, it'll pop up our website, and it'll have our contact information. You can ask pretty much any of our officers to put you on the mailing list, and you'll hear what we're up to every week or so.
And what time do you meet on Sundays?
Sundays, typically, we try and keep it as regulated as possible. We try and shoot for 1 p.m. every Sunday. We meet in front of the University YMCA, South Wright Street, just across from Lincoln Hall.
Why there?
Well, we are a program of the YMCA. That is where we are situated and we are run out of. We have our meetings as well as our storage of all our supplies there. And we do get help from the staff members at the YMCA. So it's a great place to have your club, and it's definitely been a benefit to us.
Regular listeners will know that I'm the director of the University Y, at least for a while yet, before my retirement starts. And so they'll know that that was a very leading question. And Mike responded beautifully. So, so come to the University Y. That's on the corner of Wright and Chalmers. It's 1001 South Wright. And these days, with all the construction and one-way streets, about the only way to get there is to go on Armory Street toward the east, toward the University Library. It dead ends into Wright. Take a left. Go back north a bit. And we're at the end of the block, and there's places to park behind the Y on Sundays, plus on Sundays, because of the strong Christian lobby still around, parking is free on the streets and the parking meters on Sundays. We've often interviewed Jewish guests on this program, and I've often been surprised that they're not more offended by the fact that you have to pay on parking meters on their Sabbath on Saturdays, but on Sundays it's still considered free. Well, we're about halfway through our program. My name is Steve Shoemaker, and as I mentioned, I am currently the director of the University YMCA, where I've been for the last 9 years. I have announced my retirement at the latest this summer, and the search is presently underway for my replacement. It's been a good place to be a director, and we have a marvelous program staff and other supportive staff at the Y. The Y is the oldest charity in Champaign County. It's been here 134 years on campus. The other YMCA in town, the Champaign County Y, that has programs for adults and children's and gyms and swimming pools and things like that, is different from campus-wise. The Y at the University of Illinois is one of 15 campus-wise scattered throughout this country, and there are between 60 and 100 campus-wise at universities and colleges around the world, which focus on social issues. Environment is certainly one of them, but we also have students who are very interested in education, tutoring young people in the schools, who are off doing service projects over spring break. For example, this week we've had a number of groups of 12 traveling all over this country to do fascinating service projects on many different kinds of issues. We have students at the University Y who have gotten involved in fighting human trafficking around the world. We have students who are interested in vegetarian lifestyles. We have students who are concerned with well, Mike, you probably know some of the groups better than I do. What ones am I forgetting?
Oh, let's see here. You mentioned the Engineers Without Borders many kinds of new construction projects in lower world countries, trying to help out
developing countries.
Yes.
That's right. So many, many, many student programs at the Y. One of them is involved with the environment, and we'll get to that in just a moment, called Dump and Run. But before we do that, let me mention two things that are happening at the University Y this week, now that school will be starting up again tomorrow. Faculty and staff will be back as well. And every Tuesday noon at the University Y is a special lunch program. People can buy food at the Y Eatery, great food from Thailand. And there are special lower prices for those meals for students for on Tuesdays. And this week we have a musical program. That's Tuesday, March 25th. Caitlin Caruso Dobbs, a young vocalist, very talented, will be singing some songs from, maybe you've heard from Patsy Cline or Frank Sinatra or Judy Garland or even Jimmy Durante. She'll be accompanied by Rick Murphy, who's the director of music at the University High School, as well as conductor of several other local musical groups. So Caitlin Dobbs will be singing, and Rick Murphy. This is a free concert over lunch at the Y this Tuesday, March 25th. Come at noon, bring a lunch, buy a lunch, or simply come and listen. This Friday, we have a mystery program for Friday Forum because we've had a last-minute change of plans. We had hoped to have Richard Kimball, president of the Project Votes Smart, and he's had to cancel at the last minute. But we will have a substitute, but I cannot tell you yet who that will be. But Friday Forum will happen as scheduled this Friday at the Y at noon. Coming up the following Friday will be the last Friday Forum speaker of our semester. On April 4th, former dean of the University of Chicago Divinity School, Franklin Gamwell, whose friends know him as Chris. Chris Gamwell will be our speaker talking about the U.S. within the world. Politics is the theme for this particular Friday Forum on April 4th. So that'll be a week from this coming Friday. Franklin Gamwell, he's the distinguished service professor of religious ethics and philosophy of religion and theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School, former dean there in that named chair. So we're just delighted to have a scholar of his stature come and speak at the Y on April 4th. Again, this Friday, a mystery guest, but it'll be a good program as always. This program, the Friday Forum series, has been going on at the Y for over 80 years, and we're delighted to have that continue this semester. There's an interfaith program coming up on Thursday, April 3rd, at the Unitarian Universalist Church, sponsored by the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, a Muslim group here in this community. There'll be a panel of speakers talking about the problem of evil in Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, representing several of the world's major religions. An interesting panel discussion. That's, again, April 3rd, a Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church on 309 West Green Street in Urbana. Again, that's a free program. If you have any questions, call the Unitarian Church. Again, my name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And we're happy to have as our guest today Mike Polito, who is a senior at the University of Illinois and head of Red Bison, the Prairie Restoration Group at the University Y at the University of Illinois campus here in Urbana-Champain. He's interested in finding a position after graduating in environmental restoration, ecological restoration, and will have a degree soon in integrative biology as well as in chemistry, a double major. Mike, I mentioned that one of the interesting programs at the University Y that has to do with ecology is called Dump and Run. What kind of a program is Dump and Run?
Dump and Run is one of my favorite programs at the YMCA. It's unique. I don't know. There might be something similar at another YMCA, but you don't see it very often. What it is kind of like a gigantic garage sale held by the YMCA every year. We start off by having collections right at the end of the school year. We make a bid to community members and also the student populace to donate any unwanted items. They'll send them our way. We'll collect them up and store them for the summer. And then come the very beginning of school, we will have our sale. We usually hold it at the Stock Pavilion south on campus, just at the end of the South Quad. We hold a big, huge sale there, and the idea is to try and lower all that first-year purchasing of necessary dormitory items and living utensils that you see in this huge, huge population of students every year. And instead of getting a whole bunch of new stuff, will eventually find its way to a landfill. We'll try and recycle and reuse some of this and hopefully cut down on waste. and provide a nice, cheap, affordable way for students to get the things they need.
And let's give people a sense of how big that sale is. How much stuff is collected?
I can't remember. We usually fill on the order of at least 2 to 4 semi-trailers every year.
In May, right?
We fill them as much as we possibly can, too.
Stuff from top to bottom, front to back, very tightly packed.
I know how tightly packed they are. I've been crawling through them in the past few years to make sure they are as tight as possible. Now, there's just an enormous magnitude of stuff that we get. And we've been trying to cut down, even so, try and limit what we've taken in the past few years, and we still have just plenty and plenty of stuff to take. So,
but we're particularly looking for furniture, household goods, things that students will use as they furnish their apartments and dormitory rooms when they set up housekeeping here in the fall. And we really encourage students who are listening, people who are maybe moving out of their homes to a nursing home, people who are moving from this place to somewhere else this spring and summer, do remember the University Y. Bring things by. We'll start collecting on Monday, May 5th, and we'll be collecting for several weeks solid at the University Y in May. And then throughout the summer, there'll be different days that people can bring, often a Saturday when people can bring things to the Y. And furniture is something we can accept almost any time because that can go directly on the truck and doesn't have to be sorted and boxed and labeled and all of that. So, and then we're encouraging people, too, if you can, to bring things directly to the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue in the fall. And the sale this year is going to be over a weekend, so it's going to be a little bit different than usual. It will start on Saturday the 23rd, so we'll be collecting at the Stock Pavilion for a couple weeks before that, so people can bring things directly to the Stock Pavilion, and we won't have to pay to rent the
23rd of August. Yes,
I'm sorry. Did I say that September? I apologize. The 23rd of August is when the sale will start. It's a Saturday, but for 2 weeks before the 23rd of August, people can bring things directly to the Stock Pavilion. Now, tell us what some of the things are. I mentioned furniture, household goods. What else?
Oh, what don't we have there? We have, it's like just about everything you could possibly imagine you would ever need at the dump and run. We have things from books, just tons of books. We try and get textbooks, but just you could make a whole new library out of our book section if you wanted. We have office supplies and school supplies. We have kitchen utensils. We have toys. We have electronics in limited capacity. Well, no, I'm thinking of computer electronics. That's fairly limited, but we have all sorts of lamps and clocks and
stereos.
I'm just right. that electronics section, that section, all the little gizmos that stretches on for what seems like miles when we're sorting. Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff. We even carry clothes. There's a hefty selection of clothes there if you want some secondhand
sporting goods, DVDs, kitchen glassware,
yeah.
CDs. It's amazing what we have, and we often have unusual things, which surprisingly do sell, and community people love to come to this as well as students.
Oh, yeah. No, it's everybody comes to this thing. It's not just a student function. It's for the whole community. Everybody can take advantage of it.
And the sale will go on for 3 days, and so it's a grand thing in the fall. But this spring, we're collecting, so do remember Dump and Run. You mentioned it recycles things, it reuses things, it keeps stuff out of the landfill. Now, there are some things we don't take. We don't take large appliances. I think this year we're not going to take televisions because it will cost us to dispose of any television that doesn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
So unless it's an exceptionally nice current TV, we probably won't take those. We can't take computer monitors for the same reason.
I don't think we're trying to take printers anymore either for
I think
the same
that's
reason.
Right.
These are electronics that just go obsolete after several years, and they do us no more good than they
right.
do you.
And they cost the Y something to dispose of.
But
almost everything else we're happy to take. We even take food that's not been opened, that still hasn't expired. It's a grand thing, and it's amazing how much trash still goes into the landfill, because some of us go around and see the dumpsters that people just for some reason can't bring it by the Y or can't find one of our big collection boxes on campus, and there are often good things that are could well be reused, and even if it just needed cleaning. It's such a shame that that's just filling up our landfills.
We are a society that likes the new shiny things, but we forget that our older, less shiny things are still very functional and other people would love to have them. So
that's right.
The YMCA Stump and Run is a great way to unload those rather than just throw them in the trash.
And if people have questions about that, do go to our website, universityymca.org. If you want to see some pictures of videos of the actual Dump and Run sale, you can go to YouTube, because that's part of our University YMCA YouTube video. It's about 6 or 7 minutes. You can see about our programs and get a picture of the inside of the stock pavilion and all the things that are there. So just click on, if you go to YouTube, then search for University YMCA, and we're the first one to pop up. So you can get a view there. But go to our website any time to find more information, or call the Y at 217-337-1500. And a number here to ask our guest a question about Dump and Run or about Red Bison Prairie Restoration. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 will get you here to our WILL studios. If it's a long-distance call, like our last caller, feel free to use the 800 number, 222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL is our toll-free line anywhere in the continental U.S., even if you're listening far away via your computer at will.illinois.edu. And incidentally, if you've missed part of this program you'd like to hear, you can go to that same website. And our programs are archived there. Perhaps you'd like to hear one of our previous programs for the last several years. They're easily accessible. You can go to your computer and go to will.illinois.edu, click on AM, and look for Keeping the Faith, and you'll see the whole list of our past programs.
While we are looking for many various different items for the Dump and Run sale, one thing in particular we are always looking for is volunteers. And that's not something that's just limited to students as well. But community volunteers are very welcome to come and help us out during collections, during sorting, or during the sale itself. One of the things I've noticed is the first day, there's always a line outside the stock pavilion for people wanting to get in and get the nice new stuff that's already been laid out before they get the second round pick over the day after. And one of the ways you can beat that is by volunteering just 4 hours of your time. You gain the privilege of actually going in before the sale itself and choosing what you'd like to purchase. So that's a great opportunity to get some of the nicer items as well as help out the YMCA.
And people who want to volunteer may just call the Y again, 337-1500, or email Becca, BECCA, at universityymca.org. People who volunteer 4 hours can be sorting things. They may be helping make signs. They may be helping us, if they're strong, helping us load the semi-trailer trucks that are parked in front of the Y, thanks to the city of Champaign generosity and help with keeping things out of the city landfill. So if you'd like to volunteer, we have a lot of different options. It's not all heavy lifting. Some of it may be sorting clothes, deciding what might sell in the fall. Others we recycle and give away to other organizations.
Also just labeling boxes, hundreds and hundreds of boxes.
Hundreds of boxes, that's right. Well, it's a grand project. Students for Environmental Concerns is another one of the Y programs, and they help us, many of them volunteer with this program. We have a lot of college student volunteers and a lot of people from the community. And again, furniture is a particular need. So if you have old furniture, still useful furniture, we can't take mattresses, but anything else, basically, we can't take large appliances, but anything else, we're happy to take. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the announced topic of saving and restoring Illinois prairies. Mike, when people come and volunteer, you provide tools often. You have a good supply of tools. Tell us about your intentionally burning prairies. Tell us how that works and why you do it.
Okay, so prescribed burning is the term we use for a prescribed burn when you have to burn the prairie for its own benefit. This is a pretty extensive process. It begins about at least a couple months in advance by obtaining a permit from the Illinois EPA and also clearing it with whatever local authorities you may need to, usually the fire department, and if it's park district property, park districts. But yeah, talking to whoever owns the land is usually a good idea. And then once you've gotten the okay from these various organizations that may be, then you go about creating a burn plan, which is getting like a map of the area you want to burn. It's usually not the entire prairie that you have set aside. Usually you just burn off sections each year so that each year has been burned and the other sections provide refuge for some of the wildlife that lives on your site. It's pretty harsh when everything goes up at once for them. But then you cordon off your little section that you want to burn, usually by mowing paths through the prairie to cut it off so the fire can't immediately jump over. The day of the fire, you'll have gotten all your volunteers in order. They'll all show up, and you'll usually arrange into a few teams, and there's a leader to each team watching over what that team is doing. Everybody's usually got something, some tool in hand. The most common item you'll see out there is what we call a flapper, which is essentially a shovel handle with this big rectangular piece of rubber at the end of it, and you just use it to kind of snuff out the flame if you need be. And then the other most common tool we have is probably the backpack sprayer, which is like, there are some plastic versions of this used as squirt guns by children. It's a big water tank on your back, and it's got a pump action, it's a very simple pump action squirter attached to a rubber hose attached to the tank. So you use that to douse flames as you need to, and also just maybe perhaps soak grass so that it doesn't catch so easily, whatever is necessary at the time. But you'll work in these teams, and there'll be one, usually the leader holds the drip torch, which is, it's basically a aluminum or steel cylinder, and at the top it's got this weird little nozzle with a little curl in it. It contains a mixture usually of kerosene or diesel and gasoline, and it has a cotton wick, if you will, at the end that soaks up the fuel mixture, and then you ignite it and you have this constantly burning torch at the end. And when you tip over the fuel can, it'll shoot out some fuel across the flame and then drip flame wherever you point it, which is why it's called a drip torch. Usually what you'll do is you'll have your mowed paths around your burn area, and you'll make what we call a black line on the side where the wind is blowing to. Yeah, the side where the wind is blowing to.
So it's downwind.
Downwind.
Where
yes,
you want to start the
term I'm looking for, the downwind side. You'll make your black lines, and you'll just do that in the mowed area itself. So you'll mow it down so it doesn't burn real well, and then you'll burn it again, and you'll burn just short, well, actually they're rather wide, but then you'll burn the entire length of the prairie, this wide blackened path. No fire can re-catch in there. The fire is an effective barrier for the flames that you're about to start.
So you use a burned area to confine where the bigger burn is going to be.
Yeah, and most of your time spent on a prairie burn, they'll take anywhere from 4 to 6 hours. Most of the time is spent making those black lines and making sure everything's set to go.
And so that it so stays.
So it has nowhere to run to.
Sure.
And then once you've gotten this fire area contained now, then you can start setting fire to it. And some of the more adventurous people might try and go all the way to the windy side, the upwind side, and start it there and watch it go through the entire thing. But most of the more cautious people will just run a few lines through the prairie upwind of each other, one after the other, so that you won't have a humongous blaze through your several acres. But yeah, that's when it gets exciting, because it does end up jumping real high. Your fire, till that point, has been real low, burning through mowed grass. And now all of a sudden you have 6-foot grasses going up, shooting up 12-foot flames, and they're just running as fast as the wind is blowing. It's a very exciting time. So, and then it burns and it runs into the black line that you just created, and it stops, and there are never any issues so long as you're doing it right. And so that's one of the most important things, though, is to make sure you're doing it right. And you have to be very cautious. You have to watch what people are doing. Communication is key. And it's also very important to continually monitor the weather, because it's very, very important that the there's as many factors to consider. You have to make sure the wind is at a certain speed range. You don't want it too fast or too slow. And you don't want it shifting all around the place, because it would be disastrous if your downwind area suddenly became your upwind area. You also want to make sure that the humidity is right, because otherwise it'll burn too hot or not at all. Many factors to consider when you're trying to have a burn. So
now we are on this program. We're today talking about one of the ethical issues of our time, preserving the good parts of nature that we find around us in creation. But this program also deals with religious and spiritual issues as well as with ethical issues. And I can't resist quoting one thing from the Christian scriptures. The wind bloweth where it listeth is how it was phrased in the King James Version of the Bible, as an example of, in this case, it was referring to the Spirit of God moving mysteriously, but it used as its analogy the way the wind does change, and it makes it exciting when you're in the prairies, because there's almost always a wind here in the Illinois prairies, in this part of Illinois, and it can go 180 degrees in a short amount of time.
Yeah, it has happened. It's rather annoying what happens in that case is, so long as it's still the proper wind speed, then you just move your black line, and eventually if it's going to be shifty like that, sometimes you'll just call it if you know it's shifty beforehand, and you just won't do it.
Wait and do it another
day. It's not worth any risk. But if you're already halfway through the black line, you've already invested 3 hours of time, you'll probably just black line around the entire thing.
Sure.
So it has nowhere to run, regardless of where it's blowing, and then you'll just start it up anyways.
We're down to our last 5 or 6 minutes, but we can still slip in a question or two. Do call us, 333-9455. This is a live program here on WILL. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455 to reach our guest, Mike Polito, president of Red Bison, the Prairie Restoration Group at the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois. Are college students safe with fire?
we are, so long as, you know, they're responsible college students. There's all kinds, so you just have to make sure you have the right ones watching over things. The ones that I've been on burns with have always been good with the fire. They've made sure that it stayed where it is, but they've also watched out for themselves and not got themselves in trouble out there, which is important. It is fire that you're working with, so it's important to watch out for yourself as much as the prairie. So
it's hard for people to imagine sometimes that a fire that looks so dangerous, because these prairie plants are growing 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 feet high, and then the flames are growing as high as those plants as it moves across a controlled burn. But when it reaches the edge, if it's been done carefully, it dies suddenly. Mm-hmm. And there's not that much plant material up on top, actually. It certainly is an impressive burn when it happens.
You try and get a regular burn schedule in so that there isn't too much of a buildup. But if you've been putting off a burn for a while, then you do have some buildup of duff. And then you get an exciting burn through the area.
And so much of the news we get of fires is always dangerous fires. It's house fires, it's forest fires, or maybe even in a prairie that's not controlled.
There was in Oklahoma, I believe, they did have some prairie fires or some kind of grass fires out there. But, yeah, we typically don't have that problem in the middle of crop territory. So, yeah.
Although corn, when it's dry, or beans, when they're dry, can burn, I understand.
It's a possibility. I'm not too familiar with agricultural practices and mishaps. But, yeah, I guess if it was an exceptionally dry year, that could pose a problem. The farmers would probably be doing everything in their efforts to avoid anything harming their crops. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. But
Now, what do you think of people who have planted prairie plants in their flower gardens? We've actually done that at the Y, and if people would like to see that, we had a former president of Red Bison design a wonderful landscaping plan for the University Y on Wright Street. And if people would like to see a border around a building of all native Illinois plants, it's a great example. But is that something you encourage?
Oh, absolutely. That's that's a great thing to be doing. These plants that you'll be planting are almost always perennial. I don't know of any annuals that we consider native and that we would be promoting. But, yeah, they're almost always perennial. And they are adapted to this climate, so you won't really have to do a whole lot to them to make sure they keep living. You don't have to make sure the neighbor's kid comes over to water your plants when you're out on vacation because they'll gut it out. It's okay. They're used to droughts.
These are plants that have adapted to this climate.
Exactly. Yeah. They have their, you know, 6-foot-deep root systems. They don't need to worry about drying out. If the weather's dry the week you're gone.
And they're surprisingly varied. There's some lovely flowering plants. There's even a prairie cactus, of all things.
There's a prairie cactus. Yeah, that one's a little tricky to get a hold of. But, yes, that does grow in this area. There's a native cactus. You just don't see it very often. But, yeah, if you go to a plant sale, Grand Prairie Friends hosts a nice plant sale in the spring. If you're looking to try this, they usually host it at a mall in Urbana. Is it the Lincoln
Square?
Lincoln
uh-huh.
Square. That's where they usually hold it. They sell lots of plants in plug form, so kind of like how you'd buy tomato plants at the supermarket or something, that little pot of dirt. That's what you'd be getting. You'd be getting those plugs, and you put them in the ground, and it's very simple. You have to water them when you initially plant them, like with any other plants. But once they're established, it's a very easy thing to maintain, and it looks wonderful. You can look at the YMCA to try and get an idea of what it looks like. You can also probably ask around. It's a good chance your neighbors tried it out. Lots of people do it. But, yeah, and when you're selecting your plants, you can actually target them to make sure that something's blooming at pretty much any point of the year, so you constantly have flowers going.
We're at the end of our time. I want to thank our guest, Mike Polito, a senior in integrative biology and chemistry here at the University of Illinois. He'll be graduating this May. He is looking for a position in environmental restoration and ecology. If there are any people in that area who've heard this program, give him a call. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the director of the University Y. Coming up at the Y very soon is our spring auction, fundraising auction for the Y. That's Saturday, April 5th. Go to the Y website or give us a phone call to find out about that. Many interesting things have been donated by local merchants and friends of the Y. So if you'd like to come to a nice dinner at the Hawthorne Suites on April 5th, a Saturday night, meet with some good friends, have some good food and drink, and participate and get some nice bargains and help the Y in the process, do give us a call. Also coming up at the Y this Tuesday at Know Your University is a musical program. That's Tuesday at noon. Caitlin Caruso-Dobbs will be our young singer, accompanied by Rick Murphy from the music department at University High School. Friday Forum this week is be a bit of a mystery, but we'll have a program. We've had a change in plans, and sadly Richard Kimball cannot be with us. But the following week, Franklin Gamwell will be talking about the U.S. within the world, political ethics. He's a professor of ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Imagine a country where Christians, Jews, and Muslims still live together peacefully, a place where philosophers from all three religions talk and debate openly. Well, there was once such a place in the Middle Ages. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll talk with novelist and historian Tariq Ali about this remarkable culture. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow, the low 26 degrees with north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, the high 46 with light northwest winds. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain, the low 36 Winds picking up from the south at about 15 to 20 miles per hour.
WILL programs are funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, performing computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventive maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service is also available. More information is available at 344-0800.
This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.
First of all, is your...